This is a podcast for nice guys. How do you want to be remembered? Someone who sacrificed everything, or a man who got what he wanted while positively influencing others along the way? Join us to learn how to lead from the bedroom to the boardroom from the only international coach for nice guys, your host, Ashley Cox.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to a podcast for nice guys. Today, I have Maria Elizabeth Molly. She is a relationship transformation expert and founder of Relationship Alchemy, two-time TEDx speaker and host of the Relationship Alchemy podcast. Maria Elizabeth helps women and men transform the patterns that get in the way of having loving, intimate, and connected relationships that they've always wanted. Drawing on her master's degree in traditional Chinese medicine and over 20 years of working with clients, she teaches women and men how to show up as authentic leaders in their relationships and work instead of twisting themselves to fit in. Maria Elizabeth's work has been featured in Thrive Global, Sway, and Forbes, and she is also a published author with an MFA in poetry from Sarah Lawrence College and an underwater photographer who has a thing for sharks. Welcome to the podcast, Maria Elizabeth. I'm so happy to have you here.
Hi, Ashley. I'm so glad to be here.
This is going to be an incredible conversation. We got on the call and just dove right in. And so let's rewind a little bit because I want everyone to hear everything we've been talking about up until now, and then we'll just expand on it. And so first of all, what would you like nice guys to know? What would you like them to hear? And then I would love to weave in some of the other content.
So the first thing I would like nice guys to hear is that it can be hard for women, I'm assuming heterosexual, so I'm going to speak as if. And if not, just look at the dynamics in your own relationship. But I'm going to use women as an example right now, that it can be hard for women to make clear requests. I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but there can be a tendency to be like, oh, can you go to the store and pick that up for me because I have to call my mother and the dog is on my lap and my feet hurt because I've been on them all day and da 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 da. And by the end of this whole litany of justification, you might have even forgot what she asked for, but then you're sort of screwed because you don't want to ask and seem dumb like, wait, I didn't, what was it you wanted? And so then you get in this thing where you're trying to fulfill this request, but it's gotten laden with so much emotional baggage and so many words that it's hard to find. And so if that's your experience, know that that's very common. And I'm out here attempting to teach the women in particular, because men tend to be more direct, like you tend to be more direct with your requests, and it's easy to be clear about what you want. But when you get one of these emotionally charged, convoluted, complicated requests, my invitation to you is to invite the person making the request to simplify it a bit. Like, hey, I mean, it depends on the level of play and transparency in your relationship. But in my relationship, for example, if I give him one of these requests that's got 15 things tacked on the end, he'll say, hey, I actually don't need the second half of that. What's the thing you wanted? And then I come back with, please pick me up some ground coffee. End of story. Right? And so, but he sometimes has to remind me because even I forget. I teach people how to make clean requests and even I forget. So that's the first thing to remember is if you sometimes have a hard time remembering what's been asked of you, it might not be because you're a bad listener, which might be what your partner is assuming. The reason might be is because there might just be so much extra stuff on the request that it got lost in there. So you can invite it to be simpler.
I find that sometimes my listeners are even though they're the men, they're the ones doing this.
Wow, how fascinating. That is fascinating. Great. So then my invitation to you is to get super direct and clear with what you want. I'm going to give you an example. One of my clients was getting together with their lover, and somehow the schedule got messed up. And they were supposed to meet on a certain night, and the schedule went wrong. And they felt resentful about that. Like, hey, am I not a priority? You know. And so we worked together and came up with a super clear request. And we also worked through all the objections that they were afraid they might hear to the request. And in the end, the request was super simple. Hey, when you offered to reschedule that other thing that got in the way of our time together, I would really love for you to do that. That would feel amazing. Would you? And we just got it to super clean and simple. In 10 minutes, it was handled. They got to have the sexy time they wanted. And everything worked out beautifully and smoothly because of how simple and clear the request was without the justification. So as a nice guy, like, you don't have to justify the things you want. It's actually much hotter to us when you don't, when you stand in your desire and it's potent and clear and direct. That's actually, I'm getting chills in my body as I say that. Super hot. Like, it turns me on.
So what do you think the fear is? Why do you think people, you know, sort of shroud their requests in mystery and layers of justification?
I love how you put that. That's exactly how they feel. The first is, I think, a discomfort. Well, I think that might be slightly different gender-wise, so I'd love to hear your perspective. In the women that I work with, it's very often this perception that I should be able to do it all my own. I'm an independent, adult, grown, capable person. So I have to be like in the desert, crawling to the oasis on my last breath before I can ask for help, before I can give myself permission to receive help. So there can be that. I think another, my experience with the men I coach is they've been slammed so many times for having desire, particularly sexual desire. There's been so much wounding around what it is to be a man and have desire in today's world that the nice guys in particular are like, well, I don't want to overstep. I don't want to consent. I need to have 15 demonstrations of consent before I have the guts to like go there, right? And all those demonstrations of consent, usually the desire gets less and less and less the more that goes on. At least it does for me. So would you say that's true?
I think there's a fear of, yes, that's part of it, a big part of it. And there's a fear of abandonment and rejection. And to your point, why don't I already have this handled already? Why is this even a problem? It's sort of an insult to their masculinity to have a need or to ask for help, or they're the ones that feel like they have to have it all together, and they put a tremendous amount of pressure on themselves to provide and to be the guy that she can rely on, which is such a beautiful intention, and they're not allowing themselves for it to be reciprocated, to receive. Yet that's what they truly, deeply, deeply want. They want it so badly that if they were to open themselves up for it and then be rejected, it would hurt more than just tiptoeing and not putting themselves out there in the first place. Like, it's sort of the seesaw effect. Like, which one's going to hurt less? So yes, it hurts more to put it out there and then for it to not be met or to be abandoned or rejected, because that hits a deeper wound, in my opinion.
Beautifully said. And that reminds me of something a really wonderful man told me once. This conundrum of women are asking us to be more emotionally available. They're asking us to be more emotionally transparent, more real with our struggles. But often when I do that, I'm then not respected, or I'm told to man up, or I'm told that impacts how I see you, like, kind of, it impacts how respected they feel. And so it's this double bind that's so hard. And it breaks my heart a little, because it's like, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't in a certain way.
Yeah. And I think that leadership is the, you know, if we can make this conversation and any other conversations that I have on this podcast about what does it look like to lead in a healthy, respectful, attuned way, starting with yourself, I think that is the ultimate solution to this double bind or this double standard. It's like, well, what does it look like, right? If I'm not being annoyingly aggressive, or I'm not being passive,
what does that middle ground look like? And when the man knows how to do that and starts with that, the woman, the healthy women who actually are truly invested in and respect and love the person tend to respond well.
I love the word attuned. I want to really highlight that because to me, the difference here is in the attention. You can get into hyper aggressive and not so attractive when you're not attuned to the situation, you're not calibrated or paying attention. And you can also be not stepping up in your full leadership and power and holding back and tentative when your attention is perhaps too much on yourself and not enough on the playing field between you. So when you can keep your attention on the space between you and the other person, what I call the union or the field between you, when you can keep your attention attuned to that, not overly attuned on the other person, so you're micromanaging, like, what is she feeling? That's a trauma response. Don't do that. But keeping your attention on the field between you, and what is that asking for? Is that asking for you to step up strongly in this moment? Is that asking for you to sit back a bit and invite in the next moment? What is the, I mean, this might be too abstract for most people, but I think there is a union that is created when two people come together that is what I call the field or the body between them. And keeping both people's attention on that helps you get out of like my way, my way, my way, my way. And you ask yourself, well, what does a relationship need here? Does a relationship need my powerful, strong, directed leadership right now? Or does the relationship need my spaciousness? And I have the agility to do both.
Yeah, that reminds me of what you said earlier in the conversation about complaining and how women tend to use complaining as a way to gain control over the situation. I would love for you to tell the listeners what you were telling me about complaining. So what it means when someone complains and how to lead someone into a place of stating what they desire instead of complaining. I think that speaks to that middle ground that you're speaking to. It's like, it's not just one-sided where these women are pulling and pulling and pulling and complaining and it's never enough, right? And he's overly attuned to her. And it's also not the other way where it's his way or the highway. What you're offering, the skill that you told me earlier before we started the show, to me speaks to that middle ground. It speaks to what it looks like to cultivate that relationship space, that what a field.
The union, the field. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a tendency in my experience, and I see this all the time among the women I coach, to complain a lot. They complain about what they don't like. They complain about what's not working. They complain about what they're not getting. And my invitation is always, and I want you to hear this really clearly, guys, that a complaint is a veiled desire. So behind every complaint, there is a desire that the person who's complaining is either not aware of fully or not willing to speak because it's too scary, or for whatever reason, feels like they don't have the right to ask for directly. And so I'm always teaching people that when there's a complaint, to pause and ask your, this is you with yourself first, and then I'm going to talk to you about how to handle it in your partner. But when you have a complaint and you want to say XYZ to the person, of course they're going to get defensive. Anytime you're critical or complaining, the other person's going to get defensive. It's just what we do. You have to be super self-aware to stay spacious in that spot. And so my invitation is to pause when you feel a complaint about to come out of your mouth, pause and ask yourself, okay, what do I really want here? What is this complaint a desire for? In other words, you know, you're always on your phone at dinner. I don't like that you're on your phone at dinner all the time. Well, the desire might be to have 100% of your attention on each other while you eat. The request might be, hey, would you put your phone down during dinner? Because I'd love to have your attention. I'd love to have a conversation about how our days went without the phone in it. You know, whatever the clear request is, that's going to go over so much better than you're always on your phone. Like, because I just want to go, well, fuck you. Yeah, I run a business. Why not? Right. So instead, if my partner goes, hey, would you put your phone down? I really want to have your undivided attention. I'm like, oh, of course. Hi. It's so much more enticing an invitation. And so if you are the partner who is receiving a lot of complaints, in that case, well, I suggest you first tell your partner a little bit, like preemptively in a time when the two of you feel good together, just say, hey, I learned this thing about a complaint is a veiled desire and I want to play with that in our relationship. Would you be open to experimenting with me, right? Invite them into an experiment so they don't feel chastised or wrong, but it's that you are inviting them into a new game, say. And then the game you suggest is, if I catch you complaining or you catch me complaining, let's ask each other what the desire is behind the complaint. Let's just put the complaint aside for a second. And let's ask each other, oh, I hear, you know, that sounded like a complaint. Got it. What's the desire behind it? And actually ask each other that so that you can start to gain facility with making this switch. Because it's a switch all of us have to learn to make, because most of us grew up with complaining parents, or at least one or the other. And it's just so encoded that that's how you do it. And it's just wrong.
Yeah, I find that a lot of the men that come into my work are just so tired and they complain about the women and they're sort of in a victim mentality. And I would argue that the women that they're with may be feeling the same way. So they both have these unmet desires that no one is speaking, and they're so afraid of being rejected or abandoned. Again, if I speak it and then it's not met, then that's even worse. Right. Then I'd rather hide and veil it and hope that that person cares enough to figure it out. And just, you know, this ego thing versus being vulnerable and putting myself out there and then potentially being rejected.
If your desire isn't met, if you do the piece of, oh, I'm about to complain. What's my desire? Okay, that's my desire. You ask for the desire and the person says no, like they don't want to actually do that. It's important, A, to separate that rejecting your desire is not rejecting you, number one. Number two, what I always say is ask for what you want and stick around to negotiate. Oh, I hear that you don't want to do that. Fine. Is there a part of it you might want to do? Is there another version that you might want to do that would feel better to you? Is there something totally different that you would like to do that would achieve the same result, right? I'm not saying to say all these things back to back. I'm giving three different examples of what you could say. So this idea of just because someone says no on the first pass at sharing this vulnerable desire doesn't mean it's a no forever. Could be a no right now, could be a not exactly like this, but I like this part of it and I don't like that part. And so by sticking around to negotiate and actually getting curious there instead of defensive, that makes all the difference.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And it actually does address what I was going to ask, which is, you know, what sets people up for these conversations? Like what level of, I imagine you have to have a certain level of connection and trust and love and respect to as a foundation for these conversations. And it sounds like on the back end, if it's not met with a celebratory or a hell yes, right? That there are other options and there's a skill set for maneuvering around that. But what leads up, what kinds of skills or what can be put in place to lead up to these conversations in a way that feels really good for both people? So some people listening to this podcast, they're in a relationship that's been rocky for years and there are a lot of complaints and there are a lot of unmet needs. And the man has done his best usually to address those needs, but it's never enough. So what would you say if that were the situation that the person finds themselves in?
Well, the first is when you are going to have a conversation like this that might be a notch deeper than what's been happening and more open and vulnerable is to start by asking if it's a good time. Like you don't want to just start a conversation like this on the fly in the car because you want each other's undivided attention. This is dicey vulnerable stuff. And if you're occupied with other things, it's so easy for it to go south. One wrong look and you're in an argument because there was a lack of attention. So coming back to attention. So the first piece, if it's been a very contentious and complaining dynamic for some time, the way to begin is to say, hey, I want to talk about this particular thing I'm noticing or this dynamic that's happening. Is this a good time? I'd love to, you know, and so you get buy-in. If it's a good time and both of you are a yes to the conversation, then you have the conversation. If the other person's a maybe or a no, then it's like, great, when might be a good time? Or something like that. So once you get to the conversation, you could broach it like this. Hey, I've got something important, and this word is going to change depending on the situation. I've got something important to share with you. I've got something vulnerable to share with you. I've got something scary to share with you. I've got something potentially explosive to share with you, whatever feels true. And then share why you want to share the thing. Like, what is your desired outcome? So, hey, I've got something important I want to share with you because I've noticed that we've gotten into kind of a habit of complaining with and about each other, and I want to shift that. Would you be open to having that conversation? So going into the conversation, you both know the outcome you want, which is to shift the dynamic around complaints or to shift the contentiousness or whatever it is, right? So you know going in what you want. Then you state the thing. Like, hey, I notice I've been trying really hard to do what you want me to do. And it feels to me, again, I statements, stay with the I statements, not the you. It feels to me like it's never enough. Like I'm somehow not able to meet your needs. And then that could be, what's happening for you there? Is that accurate? So you're inviting the other person to share about your experience that you just told them. And in that conversation, if you wanted to go that direction, great. If you wanted to go the other direction of, hey, I have this new tool I just learned that I want us to play with, you could go straight to, how about, I've noticed both of us tend to be kind of complainy lately. Let's practice changing that. So let's play this game where we know that a complaint is actually a desire that we're not speaking, and let's speak the desire to one another and see what happens.
Beautiful. It reminds me of something you said earlier before we started recording, and you said, so you help people get completely congruent with what they're saying, and I imagine that congruency is paramount when the person who's listening approaches their partner. Could you speak to how that person can potentially prepare themselves mentally, emotionally, et cetera, mentally or emotionally to even approach their partner?
Yeah. This is so key because the energy with which you initiate the conversation is everything. And this ties back to what we were talking about at the top of the show around making requests. The reason why we muddy our requests with a bunch of extra words is we're uncomfortable asking for anything. So this is a similar principle. If you're uncomfortable, if you don't feel you deserve or have the right to speak up in the way that you want to speak up, there's a bit of internal stuff you need to do before you actually have the conversation. You need to get right with it. You need to get right with what you want. You need to get right with what you're about to say. You need to get right with yourself as a human person. And what I find helps with that rightness is first connecting with what doesn't think you're right. Like, you can't just shove all that crap to the side and expect it not to infect your language. So the first step is like, oh, what's present here for me? When I think about starting this conversation, what comes up? Oh, I get scared I'm going to be rejected. Oh, I get scared I'm going to be smacked. You know, like they're going to come back with some snide remark. And then my invitation to you is to go, okay, what would that mean about me if that happened? Do a little digging there. So if I do get a snide remark, what does that mean? Oh, that means I was wrong and I shouldn't have brought it up. Well, if you were wrong and shouldn't have brought it up, what does that mean about you? Oh, that I don't have the right to speak up because, you know, the patriarchy or whatever. And then like, what does that mean about you? Like that the patriarchy, that the men are raped and pillaged for hundreds of years. What does that mean about you? Well, that means that I just need to sit back and be nice and not make any waves. Well, what does that mean about you? And you keep digging till you get to the core wound, which is inevitably something around I'm not worthy or I'm not lovable just as I am, or I have to perform to be loved, or I was abandoned, like my, you know, I had an absent mother or father, whatever the core wound is. Once you're aware of the core wound that's informing the energetics of your communication, then you can tend to that yourself. That's the part of you you need to scoop up and take care of and love on. Again, you don't shove it away. You scoop it up and you're like, oh, I hear you, God. Yes, we were abandoned. And that's so sad. And it's made things hard. And you know what? I've got us now. I'm here. So would you be willing to just be with me, but not direct the conversation? You can negotiate with your woundedness without cutting it off. And then that's one aspect of getting right with yourself energetically. The other is really grounding in your deservingness to have love and appreciation and connection and being self-responsible. Like if there's something you need to clean up, clean it up. Don't gaslight anybody, clean it up. And as long as you know you're operating in integrity, then what comes toward you isn't about you. It's the other person's crap. And you can be clear. You can rest assured because you've done your part.
Absolutely. I have this theory that women respond to men's congruency. Do you find that to be true? Like, even just you as a woman, do you find that you can feel, and especially thinking back to before you did all this work, I know, because that's where it's very obvious for me.
Yeah.
I responded then and still do now, but very much so back then to a man's congruency. So I could feel if there was a part of him that didn't fully want to be there. He was afraid of abandonment or rejection, or maybe he just wasn't on the same level of commitment or wanting the same level of commitment that I did. What have you? Maybe he was overworked and just sort of didn't have the bandwidth. There are a lot of things that could come up for a man. And it may be more than two parts, right? But I think that a woman, when she's having these big displays of emotion, she's sort of calling him to attention and going, hey, I feel in my body that there's something going on with you that's not congruent. And I can't tell you what that is. And I can't even tell you how to fix it. I think it's the sock. I'm blaming the sock on the floor, but really it's the fact that that's an indicator to me, that's an indicator that of something deeper, right? And then there's the material of, well, is that her stuff or his stuff? And that's where relationships get so messy. But just to keep things simple, do you find that women respond differently to a congruent man versus an incongruent man, even if he's saying the same thing?
100%. In fact, it just happened last night. We were out to dinner with a girlfriend and our server. So this is a little different than intimate relationship, but it applies. Our server was a young, very handsome man who she immediately responded to, oh, he's so dumb. And I looked at her and I was like, first of all, he's not dumb. He's just tentative. And he wants to please us. He's new. He just became a server recently because we haven't seen him there before. And I said, you know, I could feel him. And I was like, he really wants to please us. He wants to do a good job. And he's tentative about it. And so in her system, all of that landed as yuck, dumb, which is kind of probably how the nice guys land with women when they're trying really hard and want to please them and feel tentative. Now, because I could see that, I didn't respond to him that way. I found it endearing. I encouraged him because I've dropped a lot of my anger. I've dropped my gender anger. I've dropped a lot of my resentment. So I could see him and be like, here, let me give you the encouragement you clearly need. So he ended up the entire dinner like watching me as a hawk for cues about what to do next, because he was receiving what he needed in an encouraging fashion, right? And I didn't do it to have him watch me. I just did it because that's what naturally flowed toward him, because I am on this side of the work. But I'm giving you the example of someone who's still carrying some charge toward men in her system. And he just immediately landed her as dumb and yuck, turn off. She would barely look at him. She was dismissive. So that illustrates your example, I think, very well.
Why do you think women respond to nice guys like that?
Such a good question. And of course, my mind goes 15 directions at once.
There might be a lot of reasons, you know?
Yeah. I think one reason is their own resentment and lack of belief that a man could be there for them. Past wounding, obviously. And I think it's this incongruency or this mismatch between, okay, he's showing up this way. It seems like he really wants to please me, but then he's also super tentative. Like there's something where he's looking for my approval, which is not hot, because that puts me in the mother role. And I don't want to, excuse my French, fuck my son, right? So it's just not hot, right? So I think there's this element of when a nice guy is showing up wanting to do for, but is needing your approval. I think that's what she responded to with this young server. When it wants to do right, quote unquote, by you, but is needing your approval to bolster his own lack of self-esteem. Not sexy, infantilizing, mother-child dynamic, not hot.
Absolutely. I love that. That was very concise, and I'm sure it'll stick with people to, you know, that image where it's like, no, I don't want to do that. I do not want to have sex with my mother. What else is available to me other than that? Because this isn't fun.
Exactly. And
ironically, we all kind of do it before we do the work. Like we all sort of look for figures in our partners. We look for parental figures, and we're attracted to someone that reminds us subconsciously of our parents, or, you know, our brain as a child associates whatever our parents did for us and to us and around us. We associate that with love. And so if I had a mother that was critical or perfectionistic, I may be attracted to and have those, quote, those fireworks with someone who maybe I don't know this at the time, but eventually it turns out that they're critical and perfectionistic. And how much of it is them, how much of it is how the man is showing up and pulling it out of her and giving her that permission and that rope, and she's taking it. I don't know. These are questions we'll never know. But what we can do is change the dialogue. The men can lead. They can ask different questions. They can shift and get more congruent on the inside and go, you know what, to your point, I do deserve love. And it's the same work that the women are doing. These nice guys and these women both have a similar wound usually. It's like, I struggle to receive. I don't know if I deserve love. Am I worthy? Am I enough? And they're trying to answer that question externally. What would it look like for them to answer that question internally? What does that process look like?
The question of their worth?
Yeah, to answer the question, am I enough? Or am I valuable? And to finally get to an affirmative answer.
Well, I think you have to train. So our brains more naturally go to what's wrong and what's not working than what is right. So first thing is understand that it's an evolutionary impulse to do that. It's nothing wrong with you. This is how we survived in the olden times, was we scanned for danger. And to move, to make the shift that you're inviting folks to make, you need to actually actively train your brain to see what you're doing right, to see what you're skilled at, to see what is good about you. I remember when I was 16 years old and I was in a voice lesson with my voice teacher, and I sang this whole song with complicated, you know, phrasing. and I missed the high note. And so I finished a song and I'm like, oh man, I missed that note. And she's like, you sang the whole phrase really well. And if you spend your life focusing on the one note that you missed, it's going to be hard for you. You're not going to have a good life, right? And that was the first seed of cracking my perfectionism and how hard I am on myself was that moment with her. And so similarly here, if you have the kind of thing where you're constantly jockeying for approval because you don't have it inside yet, the retraining you need to do, I teach my clients to keep what's called an evidence journal. So anytime anything goes right, now this can be on the level of, oh, there's a parking spot right in front of the door of the store I wanted to go into. Yay, universe, thank you. All the way up to, oh my God, this shitty thing happened and I didn't lose my cool. I kept it together. Or, oh my God, I made this vulnerable communication and the sky didn't fall. In fact, it was received. And I felt so good and I got what I wanted. So you write down, this may seem dumb, but trust me, I had a client who was willing to do this, even though she rolled her eyes when I first told her about it. She thought this was super stupid to just celebrate every little win that she had. But after 3 weeks, she felt differently about herself. She was able to move out from the house that she had shared from the emotionally abusive husband from whom she'd been separated for years. She got a job, which is what allowed her to move out. Like, she was able to start making concrete changes in her life because of this dumb little practice I'm telling you now. So that's where I recommend to start.
So you're asking them to retrain the brain and look for the good.
Basically, yes.
It reminds me of the concept of when I'm thinking of red cars, I'm going to see red cars. And it's the same thing in relationships. If I have a wound that I am not good enough, I'm going to constantly pick up on the indicators that would suggest that I'm not good enough. Even if they're otherwise neutral, I may, ascribe meaning to something that was otherwise neutral. Or maybe if something actually was really suggestive that perhaps I'm not enough and that person really doesn't care about me and that it's indicative of that, I will be ultra focused on that, even to the point of like trying to convince them otherwise, right?
Totally.
And then I get into a triple bond, right?
Yes.
And a lot of people find themselves in those, when I have this wound of not being good enough and this person is mirroring that wound to me, and then I go on this chase to try to get them finally think that I'm good enough. And then I get a little high. I get a little high when they give me some attention or some love or some validation, if it ever comes. And it just keeps, the breadcrumbing, and it just keeps going over and, on and on.
The worst. Well, and to that point, I was raised by very critical parents. So I can tend to default to criticism when I'm stressed out. That's kind of where I go. I start to nitpick when I'm stressed. So first I have to learn to handle my own stress. And sometimes it gets away from me and I get over into criticism and nitpicking. And my partner has done so much work that when I start to go over there, again, he just doesn't, it's like Teflon, he's like, don't judge me. Judge me as wonderful. And then we both start laughing, right? If you have to judge me, then judge me as wonderful. And it diverts the energy and we both start to laugh. Or he says, or he just simply says, I refuse to be spoken to that way. I love you. And I'm going to leave the room till you can be nice to me. So he has a super strong boundary there. And again, that's hella hot. Do I like it in the moment when he does that? I don't get to rampage all over him. No, I want to rampage, right? But I respect him. I respect his boundary. It makes me work on my shit, knowing that he's not going to take the bait. I think it's a good, so this is my invitation to your listeners. It's like, as you do your work to source your worth and stop looking for your approval out there, set a boundary. I will not be spoken to like that. I love you. Make sure they know you care. You're not storming off in anger, but it's like, hey, I love you and I'm going to leave until you can calm down, or I maybe don't ever say calm down because someone will freak out if you say that. That never works. But I'm an, you know, I invite you to collect yourself. Like whatever is a better way to say that. But like, I won't be spoken to that way. I'm going to leave until you can be nice or kind. Actually, totally. I like the word kind more than nice. But
yeah, I love that. Something that I will tell people, unless it's, you know, an extremely volatile, abusive situation, I would invite them to say something like, I want to hear what you have to say. And I can't hear you when, you know, I can't hear you right now in the way and the tone that you're speaking. But I really do want to know how you feel. If you can find another way to say it that's easier for me to hear, or that invites me into the conversation, I'd love to have that conversation with you. And she'd be like, what?
Yes, I love that. Yeah, that's great. That's great.
I think a lot of times these guys are afraid of the lashback. I get the question all the time, like, well, what do I do when I tell her?
I won't be spoken to like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So they'll come on and they'll be like, well, what will happen if I tell, or they'll tell me actually, if I tell her I won't be spoken to like that, she is going to flip her lid and hit me with a cast iron skillet. She may leave. She may basically, it's like pouring fuel on the fire, and it just gets worse and worse, especially if this behavior has been allowed for years. It's kind of like a kid that you're finally telling no for the first time. And so the temper tantrum gets even worse and worse and worse as you buckle down or double down. So what would be your advice to them around their absolute, their paralyzing fear? Because it rubs up against their wounding around not being enough and wanting to please women and make them feel good. And so all of a sudden they've got this woman who's displeased and not feeling good and blaming the guy. And it really hits home for them. And it's almost manipulative and controlling.
It is.
Right. So what
it
would
totally
you,
is.
What would you say to a guy that's paralyzed by that fear and can feel it so viscerally in his body that he cannot get the words out of his mouth?
Oh, I so empathize with that. And so what you and I both offered were two different levels of play, depending on the maturity and of the players and the state of the relationship. So when a relationship is more contentious, and you have a temper tantrum throwing kind of woman on your hands who hasn't done enough of her own work yet to regulate herself and take responsibility for her stuff, then I suggest beginning with the approach you said. Hey, I really want to hear what you're saying. I really want to know what is up for you. And I can't hear it in this current form. I'm getting defensive. I can't respond the way you want me to respond when it comes at me like this. Can you say it in a way that maybe I could hear more easily? Right? So de-escalation. However, if you're at a higher level of play and you already have a good foundation of trust and playfulness, even within conflict with like Patrick and I do, then you could go directly to the higher level, you know, the more playful, hey, don't judge me. Judge me as wonderful, and break the mood, like just pattern interrupt it, because we have permission to play in those tight spots. So if you have that, do that. Or you could do the firm boundary, like, hey, I refuse to be spoken to that way, because both of you have done the work to own your own stuff and to commit to showing up with one another in a respectful way. Patrick and I have that commitment, but when I'm pissed or in my stuff, I don't remember that commitment. I'm just pissed, right? So he'll remind me of our commitment to treat each other with respect. But that only works when you are a little further along. So I think you and I really did offer two useful things to do there, depending on where the relationship is.
How does he know when it's just time to pull the plug? He's done his work. Mm-hmm. He's setting these boundaries. And he's gotten out of victim mode and sort of shifted into speaking his desires and his wants from a place of love, also listening to her desires and wants. And still, she is mean or controlling or whatever, what have you. And I know it's a tough question because you kind of have to know the relationship and know the situation to really be able to speak to it. But are there any hard and fast indicators that come to the top of your mind that a man can look for to go, you know what, this person just doesn't seem to be receptive of me no matter what I do?
Well, if you do all those things and she doesn't shift, then that's your cue. Because it only takes one person in a relationship to shift the relationship. It's like you're a lock and a key. And with the wounding and the trauma bonding, that lock and key fit perfectly. But then all of a sudden you start moving where the key is, or you start moving the lock, say, because you're doing your work, because you're taking responsibility, you're showing up in new ways, you're shifting the energy. And if she refuses to move where she puts the key of her showing up nest, then you see that there isn't a willingness there. And again, that's a conversation you could have. Hey, I've got something important to share with you. Is this a good time? Yes. Okay, good. Now, I want to share this thing with you because I noticed I'm working really hard over here to change a dynamic that we've been in, and I don't feel it shifting yet. And I'd love to figure out if there's willingness here. Like, do you want to shift this dynamic? Can we play? I get that it's hard to change patterns, but are you willing to try? Right?
And I imagine stating that with complete congruency and clarity. And so the tone is important. It's not, I've done all this stuff and you still aren't, because then it's like, well, yeah, let's revisit some of the concepts here. But if he's saying it from an inner knowingness and a deep congruency and a confidence and a clarity that I want you, woman, I want to make this work. I love you. And not because I need you, because I've started to fill in those gaps on my own. And not because my brain thinks on some weird subconscious level that you're my mom and I need approval from you or anything. I've cleared myself of all of that. I've reparented myself. I've stepped into my higher self and in my masculinity. I'm not afraid to lead. In fact, I like leading. It's okay if it's vulnerable because, again, I don't need your approval. I'm fine just stating what it is. So if I'm coming at her from that place, or if he's coming at her from that place, and she's not shifting at all, to your point, like, it's not about her being completely receptive immediately. That's not the goal
here. Because there might be backed up resentment that needs to be cleared first before she can receive it.
Lots of it. It takes time. And if he were to ask her, how does that make you feel? Or what do you need right now? And just let her talk and talk some more and talk some more until she just kind of runs. It actually raises her estrogen. So there may be backlogged things that she needs to get off of her chest. And there's no solution for it. There's no fix for it. It's just, she just needs to get it out. And so basically when he gives her this invitation or says, hey, I want you, woman, and it's from a congruent place, assuming all of that's in place and she's been able to speak her piece and she's getting caught up and she's responding at least a little at a time, I think that's a good indicator. Yeah. Versus, to your point, her not responding at all. She's completely shut down. Maybe either there's too much damage in the relationship. Maybe there was some infidelity or something that was just too far gone, or she's had an incredible amount of trauma in her childhood that she just really needs to go work through on her own. And she's not available to, you know, let someone into that level. There's something else going on, right? That's making it to where she's not responding at all. So it sounds like what you're saying is look for little indicators of receptivity. And yes, as long as there's some level of receptivity, some level of adjustment, some level of, okay, I'll let you in and I'll be vulnerable, then he can work with that and he can grow it.
Absolutely. There has to be some level of willingness demonstrated through action, not just words. And so if you feel that there are glimmers of receptivity and she reverts back to the old pattern, that's, again, you're trying to train new pathways in the brain. So she's just defaulting to her old wiring because the new wiring isn't strong enough yet. So knowing that, you can encourage the new wiring to develop by staying consistent on your side. And that allows her to begin to trust, oh, this is real. Like, this isn't just, he had a coaching session, he's going to be great for 5 minutes and then revert back. Like, this is actually real and it's going to stick. I better up my game, you know? Like, oh, I want to meet that because that feels good. But it might take a little bit before that is 100% trusted and before she can develop her new wiring to meet you there in this new place.
Totally. I love that. you said exactly what I was thinking, which is that consistency is crucial. So she can become accustomed to and know and say, I can rely on him. That's why being a nice guy is problematic, because if you're constantly reacting to the world around you, needing validation, needing this or that, you're not exactly consistent and you're not congruent. So that consistency is what she's looking for. Even if she, again, to your point, maybe it's something she doesn't like, at least she knows what to expect. That's still safer than not knowing what to expect, because it depends on his insecurities and his mood and what he's trying to get or what he's trying to avoid out of fear. And so she starts go ahead.
Well, there's one more thing as well. Now, if there's been an impact, like an imbalance in the power dynamic, and she's been sourcing what I call the toxic mimic of power, but looks like power, through being nasty or complaining or unsatisfiable, or she's not going to subconsciously, this is not up here in the frontal cortex of our awareness, she might not necessarily want to give up that power right away. So if you start showing up and you're not people pleasing like you were before, it may not go great at first. You may get pushback because she's been used to a doormat. And, you know, you might not respect a doormat, but a certain kind of woman likes a doormat. Because maybe she isn't willing to confront the places she doesn't feel powerful. And so she has to get power in these unhealthy ways, right? So if you have been very pleasing and accommodating and trying to do everything right by her, and you start putting a boundary there, you might well get pushback. And I invite you to consider the pushback as evidence that you're on the right track, instead of the evidence that you should go back to the old way, because you're doing the thing that is right for you here. And she can either pivot to meet you or she won't. But the key is not to give up the boundary that you are now setting, which is, I don't want to be spoken to like that. Please speak to me in a way that I can receive and act on effectively for us. Is that clear what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. What do you really need? What do you really want? Let's have that conversation. You know, not whatever this is. Boundary is respect. And I want to know what you need. I want to know what you want. I want to meet those needs. And where it gets really tricky is sometimes, you know, maybe the woman isn't completely clear because she doesn't know what she wants, or she doesn't think she deserves it. Or again, it'll hurt too much for her not to to receive it. And so there's work to be done around that too. If he has a conversation and she can't identify exactly, she knows she doesn't like this thing, she can't identify exactly what she wants or doesn't feel comfortable stating it, he can sort of help soften or invite her into it or give her some options so she can start to consider. And then she goes, oh, yeah, that does sound good, or that does sound nice. And that's super healing for her, for the man to care that much. And the key here is that it's not about him. Mm-hmm. So because he doesn't need her approval or validation, he can have a different kind of conversation with her. He can have a more direct and productive conversation. And she feels that. She goes, oh, him asking me about these things isn't because he's insecure and needs me to be happy so he can feel good about himself. Right? It's because he actually loves me, which is very healing.
Like he genuinely wants to give to me.
Right.
I'm always shocked at how many women don't understand how deeply their partners want to give to them. Like, it's mystifying to me. You don't have to jockey 15 different ways to try to get something from the person who loves you. It's like they naturally want to give to you. And if they're healthy, they will say no if it's not a give they can get. So you can trust that. Like, ask for 100% of what you want and stick around to negotiate.
It sounds like it's important for the man to be able to say no, so at least she knows he can do it.
Oh, it's so important. It's so key. Because if he always says yes, again, we get into this kind of infantilizing dynamic that's not sexy. But, you know, a no in the right spot that is said with love and care and rightness, congruency, that I would rather see receive that than a half-assed yes any day of the week.
It's sort of an energetic hard-on.
It is. Totally.
It gives her something to respond to.
Yeah.
And the alternative is more flaccid or passive. You know, if all of his energy isn't behind it, if his life force isn't behind it, if his mind, body, and spirit aren't all in alignment with his answer, she has nothing to respond to. Even if your words are saying something, energetically it's like, well, but is anyone really home? Does he really mean that? And again, it's like, if he can't tell me no, can he tell the world no? And am I safe if he can't tell the world no? Who is he going to let in our house? What is he going to go do? Who is he going to be with, right? If he needs validation and approval so badly that he basically lies and says yes when he means no.
You point to such a key piece there. It impacts trust. Whereas when you have, I always like to say, when you have a clear no, your yes becomes trustworthy. But until then, it's not.
Love that. So I'd love to go ahead and start wrapping up. This has been such a powerful, potent conversation. Is there anything else or what else would you like to add to this conversation before we end?
I would love to add not to undervalue the power of playfulness. And again, your relationship, if you're currently very disconnected and contentious, I wouldn't inject play right here. There's repair that needs to happen first. But when the relationship is feeling connected and good, I invite you to go out on a limb and sometimes poke or play, you know, insert a playful response in a moment where you might have otherwise gotten defensive or kowtowed or whatever the native response might have been. I invite you to inject a little trickster, a little play, because it keeps the both of you kind of on your toes. And when you're on your toes, you can't be too entrenched in pattern because you've just broken the pattern, right? And so then you can find a fresh space. When you interrupt the routine or the pattern, maybe with a little play, it's like, oh, where do we go from here? Like it kind of the whole system comes alive more between you. So I invite you to inject more play. And my other big thing is curiosity. So wherever you can, if something's coming towards you that's wonky or weird or you don't, you know, feels shitty, as best you can, get curious there. Oh, wow, I hear that. This is active listening technique. You know, someone has said a thing to you, you say, oh, I hear that you feel X, Y, Z. You repeat back to them what they said so they know you heard them. What's that like for you? Or tell me more. Or, wow, I never would have thought that's what's happening. I want to know more about that. You know, like open the door to curiosity. So with playfulness and curiosity, you can really disrupt a lot of the entrenched stuff we've been talking about today.
I love that. Where can people find you, Maria Elizabeth?
The best spot is relationshipalchemy.com. That's my website. And then on the socials, except for Twitter, on the socials, I'm available at relationshipalchemy, M-E-M. So my initials. And you're welcome to message me through Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, and start a conversation. I have so loved this conversation with you. I can only imagine how amazing the men are who listen to your show. And I'd love to talk with anyone who is curious to learn more.
They are amazing. It takes a lot of bravery to listen to this and then to practice it.
Oh, it's so brave. And I commend anyone who's on this journey who has the bravery to do it. It's just so gorgeous to witness. It brings tears to my eyes, literally.
Wow. This has been incredible for me. I'm sure it's incredible. It's going to be incredible for the listeners. You're incredible. Thank you for being on the show, Maria Elizabeth.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a joy.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of A Podcast for Nice Guys. For more Nice Guy tips, follow Ashley at Nice Guy Reform School on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. See you next time on A Podcast for Nice Guys.